You are listening to episode 93 of the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast, watching CEOs and silicon manufacturers. Episode 93 of the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast. Today is July the 7th, 2013. I'm Matthew Dean Furlough, and this is my all-American brother, James Furlough.
Hey there! I'm here.
It's true.
Hey, rock.
And American? Proud to be?
Well, American, yeah.
Nice. I'm American, too. Back in America.
Back in America. What time did you get in last night or this morning?
This morning, since I was flying into San Francisco International Airport, I did not get in until I think it was 1:30 when my plane landed, and about 2 o'clock, 2:15 when I got into the car to go home. So it was a bit of a long day. I think all was said and done, it was from when I left the hotel in Lincolnshire, and
Lincolnshire.
Yeah, it's the city of Lincoln in Lincolnshire, which I think is awesome. When I left Lincoln, it was like 7:30, and I got home at 10:30 a.m. local time. So it was it came out to be a 27-hour-long day, which was exciting. And I even got a whole hour and a half worth of sleep at one point.
Nice. Which
was, yeah. So it was good times. Thankfully, the accident at the airport did not hang me up too bad. I made it back safe and sound. And, yeah. It was all right.
That's good. That's good. And your trip was good? You did whatever you needed to do?
Kind of. Enough to leave, which was really the important part.
Understand.
Yeah.
How did your American flag shirt go over?
Oh my gosh, it was amazing. Because I'm thinking this is going to be ridiculous, right? Like, it'll just be the obnoxious American in England. And
that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, and turns out they all loved it. They thought it was great. They had like this full on Independence Day celebration, which they were like. Like firework display, they had Southern jazz music, and it was like, you know, they're playing the music, and you knew it was Southern music because they had a big old Confederate flag hanging in front of the stage.
That's Southern. I like it. It's funny.
Close, guys. Close. They had like muscle cars that they called classic cars, but like half of them were like modern air cars, just, you know, like modern Mustangs. It was like, you guys, it's so funny, man. It's so funny. The real drive to be American, but like just not quite there.
That's interesting. Huh?
Yeah. And people were taking pictures of me and stuff in my ridiculous shirt. It was great. It was a good time. I had a lot of fun and they seemed to enjoy it. I seemed to enjoy it. Couldn't ask for more. So we hope everybody in our listening audience had a good 4th of July, Independence Day. And that one quote that starts the Declaration of Independence, insert that here. We the people of this nation find it. How does it?
I don't know.
How does it go?
It's not that important.
Yeah. It's like one of the most important sentences written in human rights and self-governments ever. But you're right, not that important. Obviously, it's not that important. We don't know it.
That's because we live it.
That's true.
You don't need to memorize something when you are something.
Exactly.
It's just part of our DNA, so what's to memorize?
Exactly.
Cool. Well, welcome back. Glad that you're safe and sound and ready to rock a podcast.
Definitely. So, this week, as James is subtly implying, like every week, we'll be talking about technology in the corporate opera, or the continuing corporate opera, or the soap opera of corporations' dealings back and forth, the people working for them, their marketing campaigns, and, of course, the technology that they're developing. Before we get into the heart of the show, James has got a short disclosure that he's going to go through.
I do, and I just want to say you're sounding good on the new mic.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
You got a little bit of bass there, no more echo. It's sounding good. Sounds good.
Yeah.
And I would also like to disclose that I work for HP. However, I do not represent HP or any of HP's opinions.
Husey Packard. Yes, sir. If you want to follow us throughout the week, see all sorts of cool pictures from England when we're there. You won't get any more if you have to go back in time if you want those. You can follow us on the Twitter. My handle is at Matthew D. Furlow.
And I am at James Furlow. And you can also follow me, ready for this? It's brand new, at jamesfurlow.com.
Nice. That's
boom.
Awesome.
I finally figured out the whole URL resolving issue. Turns out I was forwarding my old URL through Cloudflare, which was causing all sorts of problems, which is a CDN or a content distribution network. And so they were caching, and Tumblr was hating it. And but anyways, check out jamesfurlow.com. You can see all of my latest clicks and links and updates there.
Nice.
By the way, clicking on About Me, and you can learn all about me.
Wow, that's nice. I like those About Me's. If you want to go on to, if you want to get more about the show, like all of our clicks and links and videos and everything we talk about this week, it's a great archive and history of all these cool articles and everything we talk about, including links to the URL and the podcast and videos and whole nine yards. Go to furloughbros.com.
Yeah.
If you go and furloughbros.com, you can get what am I thinking?
I don't know.
You can get all sorts of cool stuff there. Go and check it out. It's pretty awesome.
See the episodes, see the links to the articles.
Yeah.
You can listen to the episodes.
And if you want
subscribe.
If you want, just copy and paste furloughbros.com into your email and then email everybody on your friends list. You don't even need to put a subject or anything. Just send it to them. A certain amount of people are going to click on it and love it, and it's going to be great. So let's go ahead and do that. You know. And then
you get those emails, huh? Where it's just like someone just sends it and it's just the link. That's it.
Yeah. Well, and I never click on them because I'm like, this is probably a virus.
Yeah. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah. So see,
which makes me wonder. I've had to modify it because I used to send my title would give it away because I'd give the title of the article, and then I'd be like, this is awesome, check it out, and then the link. And now it's like, I should probably say a little bit more to make sure that they know that this is a personal send, not just a bot or spam.
See, that's the nice part about sending that email with our furloughbros.com in it, though, is that if anybody complains, you can just be like, oh, I got a virus, sorry. I hope you clicked on the link, though.
I don't know why anybody would complain.
Exactly. Yeah. Get great content. It'd be awesome.
Which, by the way, I still think it's hilarious that our dad is, I'm going to put it in quotes, on Pinterest.
Yeah.
Which still equates to him surfing Pinterest on his iPad, taking a screenshot, and then emailing just the screenshot.
Yeah.
And the title is, saw this on Pinterest. Like every time.
That's so funny. Oh, man. This is a brief aside. We got an email complaining about Windows 8 and the fact that the URL was not available for copy and pasting. And I figured what was going wrong this today.
What was with that? Because I'm pretty sure there's a URL.
Somebody, and I won't name names in this because you guys might know our mom and dad, downloaded the Google search app for Windows 8,
okay,
which is an app that lets you just type it in and it brings you to the Google search bar. It's a lot like Chrome, but without any of the functionality of Chrome.
Awesome.
And so you just type into the Google search bar, and it'll give you a list of list of results, and you click on it, and it opens it up as though it were a browser, like it were Chrome, but it's not Chrome because it doesn't have any of the user interface of Chrome. It's just the website.
Oh.
So yeah, it's like impossible to get the URL out of it. It's crazy, and I was like, what? Why are you using? Why are you using this? Just use an internet browser. That's what they're designed for. it's crazy. It's craziness.
I just want to copy the URL and there's no URL. I'm sorry, it should be there.
Yeah.
I don't know what to tell you.
I'm so glad I'm not in IT. Like, just, I couldn't even, yeah. I'm just glad I'm not in IT. So, speaking of people who are not in IT, but have caused the many people to be frustrated for days and years and over their life. This is a torture transition. Douglas C. Engelbart passed away on Wednesday, and he's important because he's the dude that developed the first mouse.
Dang.
Yeah. So the inventor of the mouse is dead. So we won't talk about.
It's appropriate because the mouse is pretty much dead as well.
Yeah, you know, he wanted to go before he saw it completely gone. Yeah, it's, you know, there's a certain amount of irony there. He actually saw pretty much the entire lifespan of his device in his lifespan.
If I remember correctly, he had the first mouse had three buttons, and he actually wanted. Holy cow! My wife is like doing something over there. He actually wanted to have 10 buttons on it, you know, one for like both fingers, all five fingers, and obviously the first mouse that became commercially viable had a single button made by Apple and Jobs. And, you know, with Apple being like, we want simplicity, simplicity, simplicity. And Jobs' logic was, if there's one button, there's no way they will press the wrong button.
Right.
you know, which you sit there and go, man, that kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
But yeah, he was the man who was like, a mouse, I love it.
It's funny. There's a lot of like gaming mouses out there now that do have like tons and tons and tons of buttons. Like you can get like 12 button mice, and everyone I've ever known that's used them says they're awful. Like they sound great until you actually realize that they're really hard to use. And it's like, even my mouse has got this like super fancy Logitech mouse that I have. It's got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 buttons if you include the roller, and I only ever use the roller and the two side and the two main buttons. The other
four, I would say, is about right.
Yeah, I mean the other four buttons, like my thumb doesn't even know how to use them if I had to. Like I don't know what they do. I don't know why they're there.
So my mouse, which is a magic mouse. Hold on 1 second. Yeah, it's fine. My mouse, which is a magic mouse, by the way, technically has zero buttons, but also has a ton of buttons. Because you can do that. It's smart enough to know like a right click versus a left click versus a single finger scroll versus double finger scroll, both backwards and forwards and left and right.
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool. It's kind of magical.
But this dude, he actually did a lot more than just the mouse. He he did this giant demonstration in the 50s, and let me read this little. In December of 1968, however, he set the computer world on fire with a remarkable demonstration before more than 1,000 of the world's leading computer scientists at the Fall Joint Computer Conference in San Francisco. One of a series of national conferences in the computer field that has been held since the early 1950s. The dude was developing a raft of revolutionary interactive computer technologies and chose the conference as the proper moment to unveil them. For the event, he sat on a stage in front of the mouse, a keyboard, and other controls and projected the computer display onto a 22-foot-high video screen behind him. In little more than an hour, he showed how a networked interactive computer system would allow information to be shared rapidly among collaborating scientists. Basically, he did a big demo on the developing internet. He demonstrated how a mouse, which he had just invented 4 years earlier, could be used to control a computer. And he demonstrated text editing, video conferencing, hypertext, and windowing. So a lot of the modern, kind of a big deal. A couple of the modern interfaces and how that would all work. And all of that technology actually got developed a little bit further by his group before it eventually found its way over to Xerox for further development, and where Xerox developed it as sort of an interesting computer science project, but never really thought of it as anything more than just that, an interesting computer science project, until one Stephen P. Jobs saw it for an hour and then took it, extrapolated it, and turned it into the original or the Macintosh operating system. And what's interesting about it is, like, reading this thing, man, dude, they worship this dude like he was the inventor of it all. Like, this guy was the visionary before the visionaries. Like, honestly, without him, there'd be no such thing as, like, personal computers. Which is an interesting now because it seems a little bit revisionist, because I actually read articles of – I went back and read articles written about him while he was still alive, and they were a little more subdued. But they're like, yeah, he had this cool idea for, like, a pointer on a mouse, but he had no idea what to do with it. Like, it didn't interface with – it wasn't like a click and drag and moving things around and, like – you know, or like the modern, you know, he didn't understand a UI. You're like, he had the idea for the device, but it wasn't coupled with a UI that really made sense with it. And like he had, which, you know, it's one thing to have these ideas. It's a whole nother idea to make a whole nother thing to make a usable system with it.
Right.
And to really have the clarity of vision to understand how all these different pieces fit together, which was the brilliance of the Macintosh team, really. Was their ability to see how all of these things really could fit together in a way that even Xerox had really underestimated. But it was interesting. I mean, but at the same time, he did the early development on a lot of the pieces of technology that were foundational to what Apple later would do and what Microsoft later would do. So it's. The dude was pretty smart. I mean, he had a giant impact on the field.
One of the things that that we talk about within HP is this idea of the actual phrase that we use is the off-ramp and on-ramp of digital to analog content. Oftentimes it's in reference to printing, you know, this idea of taking, you know, a digital document and transforming it to, you know, an analog piece of paper and then vice versa.
Right.
And that's, and at HP, we talk about how we manage that process. And that's what printing is. And when you start thinking about it in terms of that, it frees you up to do some other things, other than calling yourself a printing company, which is cool. And, we know.
Yeah.
And I think the mouse is another example of that. This idea of, oh, I want to go there, or I want to look at that, or I want to touch this. And the mouse is something that enables that, that translates your analog desire to a digital outcome.
Right.
And and that's cool. That's powerful. And, you know, change the world, essentially.
Yeah. No, it is very cool.
The dude's gone. How old was he? He was 80-something, right?
88, man. He's old dude.
88.
Yeah.
He's right around that average age.
Pretty much. That's why they call it average.
Yeah, it's interesting that we are in a time period where it's like that. It's that group right before the personal computers. You know, kind of that foundational group, the computing foundations type guys.
Yeah.
They're all starting to get old and die off.
Yeah.
And, you know, Jobs is in a different category. He died early.
Right.
You know, but we're not at that, you know, the Wozniak, Gates, you know, that age yet. They're still young enough. Even though they'll admit that they used to be the youngest and now they're the oldest. And
right.
It's interesting to watch these generational changes happen. But here's guys who, you know, they...
It's a lot of the pioneers of the early silicon.
Yeah.
Is really what it's funny. I mean, it's all the different levels of computing, really. And the guys that founded it, it really started with the guys that understood computational logic. And they're dying. And those were older. Those were like the 1800s. And then you start moving into the guys that really built the first like IBM electrical machines. And they're dying. Then you're starting to get into the guys that were building the first silicon computer chips or the first transistors. And then the first, you know, integrated circuits. And then the first, you know, yeah. And so you go through these waves of all of these different technologies where the pioneers die and go away and never come back, and you know, and then new guys have to come up with cool ideas. But that is interesting.
Which the really interesting part for me is, you know, and it's this question really, and I'm sure there's got to be some sort of analogy for this, but it's like, you know, these were the original thinkers, like pioneers, like you said, and they're not around anymore, or you know. Eventually, to pick their brains, to learn from them, to ask questions, to build upon their knowledge because they're gone.
Right.
And, you know, one of the nice parts about the internet is a lot of this stuff becomes, you know, codified and written and stored somewhere.
Somewhat immortalized.
Yeah. But it's kind of like, all right, can't ask him anymore. Can't, with Jobs, it's like, who knows what his vision was for the future? Who knows where he saw this going? We can't ask them anymore. We have to kind of start over in a sense, start with our own opinions and where we see it going. And that's a really interesting place to be. And, you know, and a lot of these pioneers, I like that word. You know, eventually they are going to die. I guess that was the same thing for cars. And what's interesting about that is you get someone like Ford who really pushed the envelope, made a ton of changes, and you know, and in his own way changed the world. And cars have stayed relatively static until the last 5 years. And even then they're like, oh, what if we make it a little different? Instead of just optimizing the current style or whatever. Let's radically try something different and new.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It's an interesting place to be at because I feel like you just can't build on top of it forever because you got to start with the foundation and you got to, until you can make huge improvements, you kind of got to understand where you were.
I think one of the reasons why guys like Steve Jobs were really able to, he was really able to define what the touch tablet should be, was because he was the one who defined really what the paradigm before that should be, you know, in a lot of ways. And although, yeah, obviously there's a tremendous amount of input from a tremendous number of groups of people, it really started as sort of like, you know, in a very big, he was very big and instrumental in the original UI that we were going to sell to people and that people were first going to get to experience. So, you know, when it comes to, you know, the big challenge that Microsoft is dealing with right now with Windows 8, for example, is trying to build something that's quote unquote intuitive, which I really always try to redefine as familiar. Cause I think intuitive is the wrong word to use. And Steve Jobs, I think, was able to build something that was very different but feels intuitive because it's based on the same paradigm of ideas, although it was very different. And it's easy for him to distill what that paradigm of ideas is because he defined it the first time. You know, he didn't have to figure out what the original creators were thinking about in order to make the next logical extension. It's just that that's where it started. Yeah, and so it will be more difficult the next time, I think, and in the next move, because you need people that really kind of can wrap their head around what was the last one, what makes sense, and what allows it to move forward. Mm-hmm. And on the flip side, you know, you've got I was reading about LEDs lately and the development of LEDs and kind of how that's moved forward. And one of the big deals is, we don't think much about the color of LEDs so much, but really the invention of the blue LED was a gigantic thing and very difficult to do. And it's like, you know, you've got these guys that, you know, they basically made a career out of making, you know, developing the first LEDs and how to process it. And then, you know, later, you know, better scientists come along. And there is still some real big ways to move forward in the computer industry, and really smart people working forward, you know, coming up with big ideas. And I have a feeling that this isn't going to, I guess my larger point is, this is not going to feel quite as much like cars, I think, wherein 30 years, computers will be, you know, a lot faster and better, but, you know, easily be able to tell that it's the same thing. I have a feeling that in 30 years, it will be very difficult to tell, you know, the similarities. You know, it'll be as hard to tell the difference between I don't know. If you think 30 years back, 1980s, you know, in large part, you know, if you look at the Macintosh operating system versus Windows 8, they're awfully similar, you know, I don't know, so maybe.
Classic view, yeah. And even OS X, you can see it's still got the Apple in the upper left-hand corner. It's still got a trash can.
Yeah.
You know, you're still dragging and dropping icons. I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah, it is, yeah. But definitely.
Now, the touch screens and mobile devices, those are genuinely different. I will grant that.
Yeah.
You couldn't look at the screen of an iPhone or Android device and go, oh, yeah, yeah, that's just like the first Mac.
Right.
Whereas OS X, you go, yeah, that's like the first Mac. And I can even see, you know, up until Windows 7 and, you know, the desktop part of Windows 8, you go, okay, yeah, I see it. That's the same.
Yeah.